Morning, 9 o'clock, time to start. There is a handout in the back if you didn't get that. And this is also available at the website studyezra.com. So if you'd like to pull it up on your smartphone, it's there now. And one benefit of doing that is that you'll get to see some of these images in color if you look at the one that's online. This one's in black and white. Let me just remind everyone that the audio of these classes is available there at studyezra.com. I usually post it on Sunday afternoon or Monday morning after each lesson, as well as the handouts. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're so thankful for this, another beautiful day that we could come and worship you and study your word. Father, we're so thankful for your word and for all that it tells us about you and about your plan for us, Father. As we study these books of history, we're particularly grateful and thankful that you've told us all about your plan throughout history so that we're not left to wonder about how we came to be and how the church came to be, Father, and we're thankful for all that you've told us. Our prayer is that we will always study it diligently and prayerfully and humbly, Father, and take delight in your word and all that you've told us. Father, most of all, we're thankful for Jesus, your Son, our Lord, our Savior, our King, and we pray these things in his name. Amen. We're still in the introduction of our study of Ezra, and we will have a separate introduction when we get to our study of Esther later. And I think probably next week we will finally get to verse 1 of Ezra chapter 1. But we have a little more to say today about the introduction. And particularly we're looking at the history of the events that led up to the first verse of Ezra chapter 1. Before we leap into the text, we need to kind of understand how we got to be there and what had happened prior to that. When the book of Ezra opens, the people of God are living in exile under a foreign king. And it's not the same king who took them into exile. So obviously a number of things have happened while they've been in exile. And last week we ended class by considering the important question, important anytime you're studying a book of history when you start it, and that is to ask, where are we and how do we get here? So we're looking at that question. And last week we started by looking at the kings of Babylon, starting with Nebuchadnezzar. You'll recall from my study of Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar was the king that took Daniel off into captivity. And we looked at a sequence of Babylonian kings. And if you look at the first handout, which is also available on the internet, and there's a few extra copies in the back, you will see that list of kings. And we started with Nebuchadnezzar and worked our way all the way down through the Babylonian kings. And when we ended class last week, Persia had just taken over. So that's where we'll start today. In 539, Cyrus, the Persian king, had ordered one of his officials to take the city of Babylon. And in fact, the city of Babylon was taken very quickly. Herodotus tells us that the Persians had been able to divert the Euphrates River, which ran through the city. They diverted it into another lake, and that lowered the water level. And then the Persians were able to go in through that channel and very quickly take the city by surprise. Daniel 5 tells us exactly what happened, and we looked at that when we studied Daniel. Belshazzar, who was at that time ruling as co-regent with his father, was banqueting, and the city was taken in one night. Xenophon, the historian, corroborates that. He says, the Persians attacked the city during a festival when all Babylon was accustomed to drink and revel all night long. It's exactly the picture that Daniel shows us. Herodotus also tells us the same thing. He says, the Babylonians themselves say that owing to the great size of the city, the outskirts were captured without the people in the center of the city knowing anything about it. There was a festival going on, and even while the city was falling, they continued to dance and enjoy themselves until hard facts brought them to their senses, Herodotus writes. Well, we knew all that because we'd studied Daniel. Daniel tells us all about that. Now, many of the Babylonians looked upon Cyrus as a great liberator. And in fact, one of the theories on how they were able to take the city so quickly is that some of the Babylonian priests had opened the doors to Cyrus. We've already talked about how Belshazzar and his father did not follow the usual Babylonian gods. That made the Babylonian priest upset, and there's one theory that they opened wide the doors to the Persians. They wanted them to come in and take things over. The Jews were also, I think, optimistic about this change that was going to take place with Cyrus because they knew how Cyrus had treated those he had conquered in the past. Let's talk about that a little bit. The Assyrians, The Syrians were very, very cruel. Very cruel. And the Bible tells us about the cruelty of the Assyrians. They treated their subjected people very harshly. Very harshly. In fact, they would move entire populations out of the land and then fill in their own people to kind of take over. So there'd be no chance of anyone ever coming back and being resettled. And in fact, that's exactly what they did with the northern kingdoms when they took them in 722 BC. Very cruel. The Babylonians, a little less cruel than the Assyrians, but certainly they followed much the same policy. We see that when Jerusalem was destroyed, the Jews were taken captive into Babylon, just as the Assyrians would have done. So they followed many of the same policies, a little less cruel. We see that in the book of Daniel, that the Jews were treated, you know, fairly well in captivity in Babylon. When the Persians took control, however, things were different. Different from the Babylonians, very different from the Assyrians. Cyrus encouraged the people he conquered to develop their own culture, continue their own religion. He even had some of his successors, they even helped and supported them in that. And we're going to see that with the Jews. But it was not just the Jews that they did that to. They did that with other people they conquered as well. In fact, after conquering Babylon, Cyrus restored that Marduk, that god we had talked about, the false god, into its kind of principal place that had been taken over by Belshazzar. So that was kind of the way Cyrus operated. Now, we know a lot about Cyrus from the very famous Cyrus Cylinder, which is shown here on your handout near the bottom. In fact, I think that's in the British Museum still. So if you ever go over there, you can take a look at that up front. And this is a very important find telling us a lot about Cyrus. And it's called the Cyrus Cylinder. It's a clay barrel. You can see the cuneiform all around it. Now, it mainly describes Cyrus's conquest of Babylon, which is exactly what we're talking about right here. So it's kind of a historical reference to what the Bible is telling us as well. Why was this cylinder written? It was written to influence public opinion in his favor and to legitimize his rule over Babylon. So it's a little bit of propaganda from Cyrus, but it does give us some interesting history. Now, the first thing the cylinder tells us is it describes the misdeeds of Nabonidus and Belshazzar. Those are the two co-regents that he took out of the way when he conquered Babylon. And it tells us kind of about some of the things they had done. But then the cylinder also gives us something very interesting because it describes how Cyrus treated the gods of the people he conquered. And again, it was very different from Assyria and Babylon. Let me just read a short translation from this cylinder you're looking at on your handout. I return to these sacred cities on the other side of the Tigris, the sanctuaries of which have been in ruins for a long time, the images which used to live therein and establish for them permanent sanctuaries. I also gathered all their former inhabitants and returned to them their habitations. Further, I resettled upon the command of Marduk, the great lord, all the gods of Sumer and Akkad, whom Nabonidus had brought into Babylon to anger the lord of the gods, unharmed in their former chapels, the places which make them happy. What he's describing there on this cylinder that you see on your handout is how he would put back in place the gods of the people he conquered, and he would put back in place the images of those gods that he conquered. That was very different from anything that had come before. Now, when we start looking at the resettlements in Jerusalem, we're going to see a similar pronouncement. We're going to read a very similar pronouncement in Ezra, very similar to what we find here on this clay cylinder. Now, one very important difference, of course, is that there were no images to return to the temple. So, in fact, what Cyrus returns to the temple are the precious vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken and stolen. And we'll see a very similar pronouncement when we get into Ezra. It's interesting when you study something like that, you're thinking, well, you know, we know that God stirred up Cyrus to do this for the Jews. Well, look, he's also doing it for other people. He's doing it for these other people he conquered. You know, I think what you see in that is that when God does something, it happens. And it happens with such force that sometimes other things happen too. So you see it happening because he stirred them up to do it for Jerusalem. But Cyrus got such a big dose of it that he's doing it for other people also. You know, we see that with the Jewish people. God set up the Jewish system in such a way that the Jewish system would continue through the first century. It's very important that they remain as a people, that they remain pure, and you see all the laws and everything set up to do that. How many of those ancient peoples are still around today? One, the Jews. They're still around. They're still a group. Why is that? That's because God set that up so perfectly that it continued long past when it needed to continue. It needed to continue up to the first century. It's still continuing today. That's how that system was set up by God. I think we see something similar here with Cyrus. Yes, God stirred him up to do that for the Jews. But apparently Cyrus was so stirred up, he did it for a lot of other people as well. Now, the Persian Empire at this time included all of Babylon, Syria, Palestine, very large. In fact, it's not mentioned in the Bible, but Cyrus's son, Cambyses II, conquered Egypt in 525 BC. And in fact, at that point, that made the Persian Empire greater than all of its predecessors. It was huge. Now, Cambyses II, in 522, he got some very bad news from Persia. Someone impersonating his brother, Smerdis, had taken over the Persian government and was claiming to be king instead of him. Now, that really shocked Cambyses because he'd had his brother murdered, and just so that wouldn't happen, and now someone is claiming to be his brother. So Cambyses hurries back to Persia to take care of things, and according to Herodotus, on his way through Syria, as he was springing into the saddle, the cap fell off the sheath of his sword, exposing the blade which pierced his thigh, and Cambyses died 3 weeks later. Now, meanwhile, back in Persia, that usurper, the false brother who had set himself up a king, who had made Cambyses rush back, he was killed by a group of seven conspirators. And not to jump ahead too far, but if you look at the seven people with the ropes around their necks, one with an odd hat on, you're seeing these conspirators, some of them anyway. And if you look at the person that this king, which I'll get to in a moment, is standing on, you're seeing the false, the impersonator who had taken over the government. So, again, not jumping ahead, but you can see things aren't going to turn out too well for them. Darius was one of those seven conspirators, though, and he was named king. So, in fact, while some of the conspirators may not have fared too well, one of them fared very well, and he's the one that's right here as king with his foot on the impersonator, and that's Darius. In fact, that's Darius the Great. And under him, the Persian Empire really reached its greatest power under Darius the Great. Now, this is not Darius of Daniel 6:28. Now, when we went through Daniel and looked at all that happened, you'll recall there's a lot we said about Darius. This is not that Darius. We'd have to go back and look at the Daniel notes to see that Darius lived before this one. This is Darius the Great, who came after that Darius of Daniel. Now, Darius the Great left a lot of inscriptions describing all about the things that he did. And the longest and most famous of them is, again, on your handout. This is the Behistun inscription, which is right here, way up on the side of a mountain. And to the next of it here, you can see kind of a description of it, so you can see it a little easier. But that's what it is here. And then that was left by Darius the Great. And you can see it's very large. In fact, it's on a cliff about 225 feet up, very large. And you can see Darius there. I pointed him out. You can see the imposter there who he's stepping on. Now, it was during Darius's reign, this king that's shown on this thing on the mountain here, that the temple in Jerusalem was resumed and completed. And we'll get there when we get to Ezra 5 and 6. That all happened under Darius's reign. And in fact, we're going to see in Ezra 4 and 5 that the Jews' work on the temple had been halted. It had been halted because of the opposition of their neighbors. And we're going to see a lot of examples of how the neighbors around them caused them trouble. But one of the things it did was it caused them to stop work on the temple in Ezra 4 and 5. Now, Cambyses, the guy who was off in Egypt that jumped back in his saddle and died 3 weeks later, he supported the opposition. And isn't it interesting, supporting the opposition of God's people, against God's people, that he died very unexpectedly springing into his saddle. He exits the scene. Darius then comes in, and he becomes king. And in fact, Darius is going to, in Ezra 6, we'll see, is going to restart the work on the temple after Cambyses is taken out of the way. Now, at the same time that all this is going on around 520 BC, God is raising up prophets. He's raising up Haggai, he's raising up Zechariah, and in fact, both of those prophets are mentioned by name in the book of Ezra. And they're telling the people to start work on the temple, to renew their work on the temple. And the people respond, God removes the opposition, and the temple is rebuilt, and it's dedicated in 515 BC. We'll get there in Ezra chapter 6. Now, the political organization of Persia was very different also from that of Assyria and Babylon. What we're seeing with Persia is that it's very different from anything that had come before. Different in size, different how it treated the foreign people it captured, different in its political organization. Very different type of system. The whole empire was divided up into 20 satrapies, they were called, and each one was governed by a Persian commissioner or satrap, and they were from Persian noble families. And they were virtual kings over what they conquered. Really, the only one they answered to was the headshot, Darius, or whoever the king was at that time. They levied taxes. They provided troops for the kings. They were divided up into provinces, and each province had a governor. Now, unlike the satraps, who were from the Persian noble families, the governors were from the local people. And in fact, we see that Zerubbabel was a governor. We see Nehemiah was a governor. We see these governors as we study through the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and this time. That's how Persia was set up. Now, Palestine belonged to a satrapy called Beyond the River. The river would have been the Euphrates. And according to Herodotus, it was the fifth satrapy. It includes Syria, Phoenicia, Palestine, all the way to Egypt and Cyprus. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Greeks, because, you know, if you're studying Persian history, you know it's not going to end well for them. Eventually, Alexander the Great's going to show up and take over. And that didn't just happen all at once. There were conflict between the Persians and the Greeks all up until that time. In fact, if you've seen some of those recent movies, I think one of them was called, like, The 300, and one of them was, I forget what the second one was called, they're about that, they're all in that history. They're describing the battles between the Persians and the Greeks right about the same time we're looking at right here. Now, during Darius's reign, the Greek settlements in Asia Minor rebelled against the Persian Empire, and they were brought under control, and Darius thought, you know, I was pretty successful in bringing those settlements under control. I'm going to attack the Greek mainland and try to get them all. But that was not successful. Darius was defeated at the famous Battle of Marathon in 490 BC. His son, Xerxes I, Ahasuerus, his son, he had served as his viceroy for about 12 years under his father's rule, and then eventually he took over as king. His great ambition had been to conquer the Greeks, to conquer Greece, to finish what his father had started. After quelling revolts in Egypt and also in Babylon, he began a Greek campaign in 480 BC. This is Xerxes I, the son of Darius. He had some initial successes, but then he was eventually defeated, a naval defeat. Again, very interesting, Salamis naval defeat. And the book of Esther takes place during his reign. In fact, he is the king of whom Esther is for whom Esther is the queen. So we'll be looking a lot at Xerxes when we get to the book of Esther. Jumping ahead just a bit again, you'll recall from your study of the book of Esther that Mordecai had uncovered a plot to assassinate the king Xerxes. Remember that from Esther? Many people think that the reason there was such a plot was because of Xerxes' humiliating defeat in trying to take the Greeks, which we just discussed. So that may fill in a little bit of the backstory in Esther. Mordecai saved Xerxes from that plot. But 20 years later, there was another plot, and Xerxes was assassinated by a captain of his bodyguard. That was 465. Xerxes' oldest son was then murdered by his younger brother, Artaxerxes I, who became the next king of Persia. Now, there was about another century or so left of Persia at that time until Alexander the Great took it over and conquered it in 331 BC. And again, from our study of Daniel, we know this history was all completely laid out before it happened. It was written down in minute detail by the prophet Daniel long before it happened. Alexander the Great, all this was described, and we went through and discussed it when we looked at Daniel. Now we're kind of looking at it in our rearview mirror because we're seeing it here as it has happened or was about to happen. You know, why did Persia fall? Interesting. I mean, you talk all the time about why Rome fell. Well, here's another question. Why did Persia fall? Certainly, you know, a lot of different reasons. Increasing taxation was one. The greed of government officials was another factor. The impoverishment of the people, another factor. Here's what one historian said. The traditional explanation of the fall of the Persian Empire is a result of abuses of their positions by those in power, the decadence and corruption at court and among the aristocracy, combined with a fall in the standard of living of the common folk, can be further documented by Babylonian tablets. In other words, you can go back and look at it. And it was increased taxation, it was decadence, it was corruption, it was the aristocracy who thought they were above everything. You know, you look at that, you then look at Rome, you just have to wonder, you know, how many times is that going to repeat? But it has repeated throughout history, and a very similar situation with Persia to what we discussed when we looked at Daniel about the fall of Rome and what led to that. Let's talk about the Jews. We've just gone now through the history of the Babylonians, and we looked at the Persians, and we've gone all the way up to the doorstep of Alexander the Great. What was going on with the Jews at this time? Because that, of course, is the real focus of the history here. Now, the Babylonian siege all the way back in 597 B.C., and the deportation that followed, that would have been when Daniel was taken off, and also King Jehoiakim, that's the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. That's usually where it's pegged, at the beginning of it, in 597 B.C. And, you know, certainly if you'd been captured in war, you know, if you were fighting against them and you were captured, you would go back as a slave. And many of the exiles were poor and impoverished, certainly. But the situation of most of the Jews in Babylon appears to have been pretty good. I mean, pretty good, relatively speaking, to what had happened to their northern tribes, and pretty good, relatively speaking, considering what could have happened to them. But for the most part, it was pretty good. King Jehoiakim and his family were confined, yes, but they were also released in 562 B.C., and the rest of the Jews apparently were free to settle in communities and engage in agriculture and kind of have trade. And in fact, that explains why, when they were given an opportunity to go back, many of them, in fact, I would say probably most of them, did not go back. They stayed right there in Babylon and did not go back to Jerusalem. And in fact, that's why, because they weren't really being treated that badly. Many preferred to remain there. Now, during their captivity, though, in fact, after they remained there, we call it captivity, but many of them seem to have settled there and kind of gotten in with the program and become part of the culture. And in fact, they were influenced greatly by that culture. They were greatly influenced by that culture. Perhaps the most important influence is the Aramaic language. That's when the Aramaic language became the language that they all spoke. It was during that captivity. Babylonian influences are also seen in the names. We're going to see a lot of names in the book of Ezra and Esther, and you're going to see a lot of them are Persian names or Babylon. They're not Jewish names. I mean, Sheshbazar, Zerubbabel, those are not Jewish names. Those are Persian names. So, in fact, they adopted the culture and the language and named their children the names of Persia. You can see that throughout history, and you can see that here in the book of Ezra. Now, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, they greatly influenced the Jewish captives in Babylon. Ezekiel was there among them. Jeremiah had prophesied before, but they had his writings. We see Ezra reading Jeremiah. We see Daniel reading Jeremiah. They were reading these prophets as well, and the people were reading them as well. Now, before the fall of Jerusalem, we know that few in Israel heeded these prophecies, particularly those of Jeremiah. We can read the book of Jeremiah to see how he was treated and how his prophecies were treated. And in fact, if you look at Jeremiah's lifetime, I mean, a lot of people might have looked at that and said, Jeremiah, this is just a complete failure. You haven't convinced anybody of anything. But as they read his writings and they saw everything he said come to pass just as God had said, and they saw the return just when God had said it would be, of course, the people then understood that Jeremiah had been a prophet from God, and they heeded him. And we see the influence of Jeremiah coming through all of these writings and all through Ezra and Esther. Now, after carrying away the, you know, the best of the population, which is what they were doing. Remember, I mean, Daniel was the that was he and his friends were the best of the population. That's who they carried away, the best, the royalty. Babylonians did not bring the other people into Judah, as the Assyrians had done. The Assyrians would resettle the area. You know, they would clear out the people, then they would bring in Assyrians to resettle the area. The Babylonians didn't do that. They just left it empty. And in fact, there was kind of a vacuum in Judah at that time. It was very sparsely populated. Archaeology confirms that. They go back and look at this time and they say, yeah, at this time, there was hardly anybody living there. Very sparsely populated. And that's been documented also with archaeology. Egypt. Since the time of Joseph, the Jews had frequently looked back with fondness on Egypt. Even as they were being led out of Egypt, we know they were looking back with fondness on all the wonderful things in Egypt, and we know that continued. In fact, they were repeatedly admonished by the prophets, what? To not try to find security in Egypt. The prophets would always tell them that. You're looking for human alliances with Egypt. Trust in God. That's throughout the prophets, but the people kept looking back to Egypt. And in fact, some of them migrated there after the northern kingdom fell in 722, and some of them went to Egypt after the fall under Nebuchadnezzar. How do we know that? Because you read about it in Jeremiah. In fact, Jeremiah was one of the people that went to Egypt. He was taken with them to Egypt, so he went to Egypt. This is supported in the Elephantine papyri. That's not on your handout, but that's our primary source of extra-biblical evidence for what was going on in Egypt at this time. And it's a collection of papyri from about the 5th century B.C. From Jews living there in Elephantine near the Nile, in the Nile. It was an outpost founded around the 6th century. It's a bunch of legal documents and letters, but it tells us a lot about the Jews who were living there at that time. And again, we read about that in Jeremiah. Now, in both Ezra and in Nehemiah, we're going to read a lot about the neighbors of the people, the neighbors of the Jews when they return. And the neighbors were not very neighborly. They were fierce enemies of the Jews. And we're going to see all the oppositions that they put forward to what was happening at that time. Judah was surrounded by all these other provinces. We've talked about how it was part of a province. Well, there were provinces all around it as well, and various governors all around it. And we're going to read about some of these governors that were nearby. Tobiah was the governor of Ammon-Gilead, which was to the east. Geshem was the governor of Arabia-Idumea, which is on the south. So all these provinces around it. And we're going to be reading about those as we go through here. But you know, the point to keep in mind here about the Jews is that, yes, they were carried off into Babylon, but they assimilated into Babylon. And in fact, you know, today you look at the Talmud and some of the Jewish writings. Most of the Jewish writings that they refer to today were written in Babylon, the extra-biblical, the non-biblical Jewish writings. Many of them were written in Babylon, and it's had a major influence on the Jews even to this day. Some even argue that the books of Moses were written in Babylon. And of course, we know that's not the case, and we're going to talk more about that in a moment, maybe next week when we get to it. But some people go that far as to argue that, and of course, that is not the case. We'll talk about why it's not when we get there. Now, you know, one very nice thing about not having a quarter system here is that I can occasionally take little diversions and not get way behind in time. And one of the ones I want to talk about a little bit here is the role of time in the book of Ezra. Because as I went back and studied Ezra again for these classes, there was something about the time in Ezra that struck me. And I wanted to talk a little bit about it because it's very unusual as to how time is dealt with in the book of Ezra. Usually when you pick up a history book, you're going to expect it to go chronologically from beginning to end. And very often at kind of the same pace throughout. You know, if you spend so much time here, you're going to kind of do the same pace beginning to end. And certainly much of Ezra is chronological. But there are also parts of Ezra where Ezra will get out of the chronology and do some things out of order. And in fact, if you look at your handout, what you'll see at the top are the kings, who we just talked about, in the black boxes there. At the top, you'll see some kind of markers to some other people that were around at the time. But at the bottom, you'll see these are the sections of Ezra right here. For instance, chapter 1:1 through 4:5, and then 4:24 through 6:22. These are in the book of Ezra, and these are arranged chronologically at the bottom. But what you can see is that if you start off chronologically, suddenly in chapter 4, verse 6, you leap over here, and then you leap way over here, and then you leap way back over here, and then you leap over here. There's a lot of leaping back and forth in time. Now, it's all, I think, explained in the book of Ezra, and we'll talk a little more about it when we get to these parts of the text. But my question, which I'd like us to consider now, is why? Why did Ezra write this way? I mean, why is it that Ezra is kind of leaping back and forth through time a little bit? What point is he trying to make by doing that? I mean, again, it's not like your normal history book, so there must be some reason behind it. And I think it's probably better for us to kind of do it in an introduction where we can step back from it and kind of look at all the examples and try to figure out why Ezra wrote it that way. With the very first words of the book of Ezra, we're riveted to a timeline. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, I mean, he nails it. That's when this happened. First year of Cyrus, king of Persia, he tells us. Now, by the way, that first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, is the first year when he was in control of Babylon. It's not the first year of his reign over Persia. It's the first year of his reign over Babylon. But he nails it on time. At each successive turn of events, Ezra will give us another temporal marker, another time marker, another pin on the timeline. And in fact, there's over 40 different time markers in the book of Ezra. In fact, the book ends with a time marker all the way back in chapter 10, around verse 17. They made an end with all the men that had taken strange wives by the first day of the first month. And in fact, he gives us the year elsewhere. So we know down to the day when this thing happens. Ezra, in the beginning, in the middle, in the end, every part of the book of Ezra shows a very careful attention to time. But at the same time, that all those time markers create a little bit of a problem for us as we study the book of Ezra. Again, as I mentioned, we would expect a history book to be very strictly chronological and go in chronological order. And that's just not the way it happens in the book of Ezra. I mean, much of it's chronological, but some of it's not. After covering more than 80 years with some gaps of the post-exile history from chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 4, verse 23, without skipping a beat, Ezra jumps back 63 years to 520 BC in chapter 4, verse 24. He then picks up the account after the completion of the temple in chapter 4, verse 5. And then, after going through all that history, he says, after these things, and suddenly we're transported 57 years into the future over all that's happened in between, and we're in the seventh year of Artaxerxes. The first six chapters, Ezra splits very nicely into two sections, chapters 1 through 6 and then the end. The first six chapters cover about 80 years. The last section of Ezra covers precisely 1 year. 1 year to the day. 1 year to the day. 458 B.C. to 457 B.C., the first of the year. So, in fact, there's not just leaping around in time, there's a different pace of time. Sometimes you're moving along moderately in the book of Ezra. Sometimes you're inching along name by name as he gives us a genealogy. And sometimes we're galloping along as quickly as he can write. I mean, the pace is different in the book of Ezra. The time is different in the book of Ezra. Here's the question for us. Is this odd treatment of time in the book of Ezra telling us something? Is it part of the message of Ezra? Is there something that Ezra is telling us by doing it this way? And if so, what is it? And the answer is yes. I think there is a very important message in how Ezra, under inspiration, of course, is relaying this account. Now, there are really four significant departures from the usual chronology that I want us to look at. Two of them involve chapter 4. One involves chapter 6, and one involves chapter 7. Let's look at kind of the big one, which is the first one. And it occurs between chapter 4, verse 23, and chapter 4, verse 24. Between those two verses, the text switches from the time of Artaxerxes all the way back to his grandfather, Darius the First. And that's what I want us to look at first. What's going on there? Why that switch? What's happening there? Well, the first two chapters of Ezra are going to recount Cyrus's decree to rebuild the city and rebuild the temple. And it's going to recount the people's return to the land. Chapter 3 begins with all the sons of the exile gathering in Jerusalem on the first day of the seventh month, Cyrus's reign, to restore the altar, to reestablish the sacrificial worship. About 2 years later, Jeshua and Zerubbabel are going to stir up the people to lay the foundation for the temple and begin its reconstruction. That's chapter 3, verse 8. And after refusing their adversaries' request for help, the Jews then face 15 years of organized opposition up until the reign of Darius. That's chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Now, during the reign of Ahasuerus, their enemies lodge another complaint against them. That's chapter 4, verse 6. And the rest of chapter 4, verses 7 through 23, record two other instances of opposition. And these occurred during the reign of Artaxerxes. You can again see these on your handout. The second of those resulted in an imperial decree ordering the cessation of the building of the city walls. Now, up until this point, we've been following a chronological timeline. Yes, there have been some gaps, there have been some leaps, but at least the arrow of time has been moving this way up until this point. But in the final verse of chapter 4, we see Darius's name reappear. And what we find is that time at that point has gone back. because now we're back in Darius. We had leaped forward in time, and now at the end of chapter 4, we're coming back to Darius. That 35-year gap between chapter 4, verse 5 and chapter 4, verse 6 is reopened, and suddenly we have about 700 words telling us all that happened in that gap. Why tell us about the opposition of the building of Jerusalem's walls, opposition that happened years after the rebuilding of the temple, before Ezra tells us how the temple was rebuilt? Why does he go through all this opposition and then come back and tell us how the temple was rebuilt? Well, the chronological facts, you know, what was happening chronologically was that, the opposition that was instigated by the Samaritans who lived around them, they did succeed in hindering the temple's reconstruction until Darius' second year. And at that time, that's when Haggai and Zechariah came into play and said, come on, get busy, get the thing rebuilt. Tatnai, the governor, investigated this rebuilding, and he sends a report to Darius to confirm the Jews' claim, and he requested instructions on how to proceed. That's all in chapter 5. Darius supported the work. The rebuilding of the temple was completed. That's chapter 6. That's after Cambyses had been killed on his way back from Egypt. It was later, sometime later, during the reign of Xerxes and Artaxerxes, that the opposition resumed, that there was continued opposition. Why is that told out of chronological order? I think to really understand that, you have to look at the effect it has on us as we're reading this, the effect on the reader. That will tell us the message that we're intended to get from this. As we're moving into chapter 5, it looked like the Samaritans had won. And the Jews were in for another beating, this time from Tatnai, the governor. But Darius's support is a complete reversal. It's unexpected. Darius comes back and says, you're right. Cyrus did order this. Start rebuilding. And here's the money, here's the funds, here's the protection. Completely unexpected. And that's what Darius does. Of course, we know who was pulling Darius' strings. But still, I mean, God was in control of this. But it was completely unexpected from looking at the history of it. Darius' decree transformed the reconstruction from a beleaguered effort to an imperially supported project. This was a project of the king. Yes, it had adequate resources. Yes, it had authority. Darius himself was supporting it. That's the kind of reversal that we see here. Now, when we finally get to Esther, what we're going to find is that Esther has two major themes, one of which is banquets and feasts. The other is reversal, reversal. Esther is filled with reversal after reversal after reversal. The theme of Esther is reversal. I think we're seeing that here in Ezra. It's just very subtle in Ezra. What we're seeing here is reversal. Darius' decree reverses all the frustrations that had come about through all these oppositions. Hostility is turned into help. The good guys win. The bad guys lose. God comes through for his people. These are all the themes that we're seeing here. I think it's summarized by Ezra's closing point there in chapter 6, verse 22. For the Lord had made them joyful and turned the heart of the king of Assyria unto them, to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. The Lord had made them joyful. Joyful from what? Joyful from sorrow. It was a reversal. It was a reversal brought about by God. Again, we're going to see that all throughout Esther, but we see that here in Ezra. Now, for those who noticed in chapter 6, verse 22, that I just read, for those who noticed that the king of Persia was called the king of Assyria, you may have wondered, well, why was that? Stay tuned. We'll eventually get to chapter 6, and I'll deal with that when we get there. But that's the kind of conundrum we'll be dealing with as we work our way through Ezra. Now, this reversal, I think we can kind of think of it as kind of the thematic fulcrum here. This is what it's all turning on, the first half of the book. Israel's audience is living in the aftermath of what the Samaritans had done. And we're going to read all about their opposition and all the problems they created. You know, have you ever had a bad neighbor? Okay, the Jews had a bad neighbor. I mean, it was bad. It was really bad, and they were stuck there. They couldn't move. They were stuck there. The neighbor wasn't going anywhere, and it was bad, and that's the situation they had. And in fact, that had caused all the work to stop. They'd been prospering, and then the Samaritans come along and cause all this work. And it happened again and again and again. And I think that's what's going on here in chapter 4, is that he's recounting the oppositions. But he goes forward in time to say, look, it kept going. It didn't just happen here. It happened here, it happened here, it happened here. And he gives more examples of it. And then he comes back to where he was before he started giving those examples. A significant part of why Ezra was writing this book for his initial audience was to revive their hope, for the future. Why? How do you revive your hope for the future? Well, if you're a child of God, you revive your hope for the future by doing what? By looking in the past. Because if you look at what God has done for you in the past, you're going to have nothing but hope for what he's going to do for you in the future. And I think that's what Ezra is doing here. He's cementing them down in what God had done for them. And he's letting them know, and God is going to keep doing this for you. God is going to help us, and he's going to make this work. And I think that's kind of the message as we see here. How do others deal with this change in chronology? How do others deal with the fact that, in fact, this book is not in a strict chronology, that sometimes it jumps around a bit? How do others deal with that? Well, radical critics, they denounce the whole book because of that. They say, oh, come on. Torrey describes the book as a chaotic jumble of temporal fragments, misaligned and incomprehensible. Batten arguments that multiple editions of the book have left it very badly arranged. Other critics complain about its chaotic order. We could say a lot about the radical critics, but let's just mention a few of their problems now. First and foremost, they reject the inspiration of the text. I mean, that's why we call them radical critics. They completely reject the inspiration of the text. They treat this simply as a product of man, and when you're doing that, you're going to go wrong every time. So, that's the first problem they have. Huge overwriting problem. Second, they treat the text as simply a history text, which, again, one might expect to be chronological. But this book is so much more than history. Remember, that was the first thing we said on the very first lesson. It's so much more than just history. This is a theological book. It has messages to convey. So, in fact, Ezra very well might rearrange the chronology a bit if it's going to convey the message that God once conveyed through that book. And in fact, that's what we see happening here. Third, these radical critics are so arrogant. I mean, you just have to sit down and read them to see the arrogance just flowing off the page. If Ezra didn't write the book exactly the way they would have written the book, then Ezra, out the window with Ezra. I mean, in other words, it had to be exactly as they would have written it, or Ezra's completely at fault. I mean, the arrogance just comes through the page as they're discussing this. Now, that's one approach, and of course, we reject that completely. But another approach has another problem, and that is, and you sometimes see this with conservative commentaries, and that is they have a forced chronology. They say, okay, Ezra must have written this in chronological order. He must have. So therefore, we've got to take what Ezra wrote, and we've got to match it up to the timeline, even if we have to change the names of some kings to do it. And they changed the names of kings to do it. Josephus is actually a pretty good example of that. We've talked a lot about Josephus, of course, ancient historian, not inspired, not part of the Bible. According to Josephus, the Artaxerxes of Ezra 4 was Cambyses, the son of Cyrus. He changes the name. That does kind of smooth out chapter 4, but it leaves Ahasuerus hanging. We don't know who he is. We often refer to Josephus a lot, and Josephus got a lot of things right. But Josephus also got a lot of things wrong. So we need to always keep in mind Josephus is not part of the Bible. Josephus was not inspired. Just to give an example, Josephus places the return of Ezra and Nehemiah and says Nehemiah arrived in Jerusalem in the 25th year of Xerxes. That's what Josephus says. Nehemiah arrived in the 25th year of Xerxes. Xerxes reigned for 21 years. He didn't reign for 25 years. He didn't have a 25th year. So, again, just because someone mentions Josephus, we have to consider him as we do with other non-biblical writings. They can be right, they can be wrong. It's not part of the Bible. I think the best view is the one we've discussed here for the first anomaly, which we've just looked at, and that is that Ezra departs from a strict chronology on occasion. Why? To make an important theological point. Ezra is not just writing a book of history. Yes, it is history, but he's doing so much more than that. And we can see that, I think, by looking at how time is dealt with in Ezra. The second one, which we'll have time to start briefly, is in chapter 7, verse 1. Chapters 1 through 6 begin with Cyrus's first year and end with Darius's seventh year. That's 21-year time span. The total time span, though, covered by the first six chapters is really 80 years because of how it jumps forward in time. There's some gaps, but it jumps forward all the way to Artaxerxes, as we see from chapter 4, 6 through 23. Chapter 7 comes along. In the first verse of chapter 7, we read, "After these things in the reign of Artaxerxes." Okay. After these things. The question is, what things? What things is he talking about here? Clearly, Ezra is giving us a sequence. He's using the word after, and he's referring to something that came before. So we need to figure out what's the sequence here. What are the things that Ezra 7 is referring to? Well, we have, you know, at least two options here. The first and the simplest view is that it's chapter 1 through 6. That chapter 7, after these things, is referring to chapter 1 through 6, after what I just talked about. Well, the problem with that is that chapter, we've seen some leaping forward in chapter 4, leaping forward in time. So the real question for us is, does the after these things refer to that leap forward, or is it after some other things that he talked about in chapter 1 through 6? And we'll start there next week. I'm hopeful that we'll actually get to chapter 1 by verse 1 by next week. Next week we'll look a little bit more at the time and then a few other items, and then we'll move in. I haven't really stopped for any questions, I realize, but at the end of the introduction, I'll stop and ask for questions, and you're always free to ask questions at any time, and you can always email me or call me or whatever, or ask here whenever. You can ask any questions at any time, certainly, but I will make some pauses between sections to specifically ask for them. And again, the audio from this class will be available later today. Thank you very much for your attention.